Welcome to Real Vision. It's Friday, December 11th, 2020, just after market close in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington, joined shortly by our managing editor, Ed Harrison. But first, with the day's stories, Jack Farley and Weston Nakamura.
Thanks, Ash. I'm joined by a very special guest, Weston Nakamura, who's a veteran trader from Goldman Sachs and Jefferies, but now he has joined Real Vision in our community platform, The Exchange. Weston, so great to have you on the Daily Briefing.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Weston, I know that you've prepared a few charts as well. You also gave me some instructions. So I, my Bloomberg terminal fired it up and made a few charts of my own for you. So let's get right into it, because this is the intro. What are you seeing with regards to Japanese equities relative to China, and as well as perhaps a proxy to the value and growth trade?
I'm just going to keep this really quick because everything's going to be on the exchange. But basically, value versus growth, if you believe in that sort of momentum shift that's happening right now from value to growth, you can actually play it instead of doing the QQQ versus the IWM, the Russell 2000 versus the NASDAQ. You could actually just go long Japan and short China. It's a regional macro play as well. China has been this growth engine for 30 years with 5-6% GDP growth. Japan has been just nothing for the last 30 years. And this is sort of a macro version of that. You also have kind of weird similarities as well in terms of like regulation from Chinese authorities on the tech sector, regulation from US authorities on the US tech sector. Japan is basically this otherwise forgotten sort of asset that people, when there's a lot of froth in the markets, look for, and they see Japan with very little political volatility, with not at all-time highs, COVID cases relatively kind of under control, and so Japan looks like the attractive long if you're going to go long in DM equity.
I actually have a challenge for you, but we're gonna save that for the exchange because we have to move on. What do you see with the USD JPY trade compared to the Nikkei S&P ratio? I know you have an interesting chart showing that they're matched, but now it appears that the dollar yen is a little bit dislocated from that ratio of the Nikkei to the S&P. What are you seeing there?
Yep. So the Nikkei and the S&P ratio tracks USD JPY usually pretty spot on. And right now, they've diverged, so it actually gives you an opportunity to go long Nikkei if you want to go long, and you could actually hedge it by going long the yen as well, should there be a pullback, and you get some yen strength.
Great. There's another chart I want to talk about quickly. I'm not going to talk about it, but I just want to quickly mention it and put it on screen. It's the interest rate differential between the dollar and the yen 10-year yields, real yields, I should say, and then relative to the USD JPY spot rate. But this is just the intro. We're plowing through the snow, Weston. Let's go right ahead to the next chart, which is the 1 month implied volatility of the dollar yen to the Turkish lira yen. That, of course, those are currency pairs. What do you make of that?
Okay, so this chart tells a whole story of basically two separate central banks with two totally different management systems. One of them is very cool. That's Japan. They've been controlling the yield curve since September of 2016 with the yield curve control. JGB 10-year yields are going to be at around zero. Turkey, on the other hand, has brought their rates from 8% to 25%, down to 8% again, and now they're hiking it back again. And that's been across three central bank governors. Mind you, the last one was fired. The next day after he was fired, the finance minister of Turkey, who happens to be Erdogan's son-in-law, quits his job via Instagram. And people were kind of freaking out, thinking that his account got hacked. But no, he actually quit through Instagram. This is what finance ministers do there. So that's displayed right there in that in the implied volatility chart of the lira.
Yeah, it really is a tale of two currencies. Moving on to the next chart of the Turkish lira. In the blue line, we have the overnight rate, which is set by the Central Bank of Turkey. Which, as you said, has gyrated from 10% in 2017 to up to 25%, then down. But as the lira devalued to as low as $10 per $1 over the past few months, that rate has risen. What do you make of the chart that I made is of that overnight rate relative to inflation. And it actually seems that for most of the past 5 years, real rates in Turkey have been positive. What do you make of that?
Real rates have been positive, but because the only reason that's significant is because when people think like, oh my God, they have a 25% policy rate. Yeah, but that's because they have a 25%, you know, interest rate. And also that's their CPI. That's not the actual on the ground interest rate. You have food inflation at like 30, 35%. You know, everyone has their own inflation, as they say. Turkey's is not at 12 or 15%. It's far higher.
All right. We'll have to get into that. Maybe I'll just dig you a little bit on the exchange. Again, Weston and I will be having a much more in-depth conversation on these charts and giving these charts the detail they deserve. But for now, Weston, let's move on to your next chart, which is a topic that is very fond of some Real Vision members as well as Raoul. It charts the correlation between the S&P 500 and Bitcoin. What do you make of this?
Yeah, so this chart is actually from a member of the exchange who basically brought this in. And what you have is the S&P 500 correlating, and it's a 20-day correlation with, Bitcoin's 20-day correlation with the S&P 500, which is essentially a one-month correlation. And what you'll notice is over the last few months, there have been these sort of precipitative drop-offs in correlation right at month end, almost down to the day. And I personally don't know what's behind that, you know, honestly, but what that kind of suggests to me is that this sort of behavior, this month-end behavior, is starting to look almost institutional in nature, in terms of rebalancing and things like that. And it suggests
And sorry, Weston, sorry to interrupt you. Can you tell the viewers at home just why the fact that it's at the end of the month, you know, what does that mean for portfolio managers? What is rebalancing? Can you tell people at home?
So if you're mandated to be 60-40, for example, and your equity portions go up a lot, you have to sell that down, you have to buy more bonds, and you have to keep that 60-40 balance. It's a rebalance. And so there's a lot of month-end flows that happen in times of large asset price swings during, a course of a month. And that should have nothing to do with Bitcoin fundamentally, but apparently you're starting to see these movements in correlation. This is realized correlation. So there's obviously something happening, and it is not the retail investor who's every month at month end doing anything. This has the footprints of institutional flows and institutional behavior. And I think we're starting to see the institutional money actually starting to impact a little bit.
Well, that's an interesting chart for sure. I have so many questions, but I'm going to have to save them for our in-depth conversation on the exchange. Remember, for the folks at home, if you liked having Weston on, you want to hear more about these charts, and rather than just having Weston go through it like this, and actually want to hear some analysis and some real detailed conversation, and we're going to be having that in the exchange. So please click on the link in the description below. Thank you, Weston.
Thank you so much, and I want to hear your analysis too, and that's what the exchange is all about. So come and we'll have a discussion about it. Right? It's two-way.
Absolutely, looking forward to it. All right, thanks. Back to you, Ash.
Welcome back, Ed. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Hey, that reminds me, actually, since it is Friday, I need to go get something. Let me go off camera for a second and put on a different outfit really quickly.
Oh, boy, this one makes me nervous. The sound of zippers in the background.
Okay, here we go. That's what I wanted to do for you there, Ash.
Very nice.
All right. How do you like it?
Very nice. Well played, sir. Very well
Excellent.
Played.
Excellent. What do you got for us today?
Ed, I feel like it's a tech Friday. A lot of tech stories that we were talking about earlier, right back, big picture, tech eating the world. A lot of stories that suggest that explore those issues. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, actually, there was a piece by Kara Swisher in the New York Times that I thought was apropos, and I think that's where I would lead off in terms of tech. I mean, if I could frame the issue, what I would say is that a lot of people, I talked to a guy earlier today, actually, who is the, he's the portfolio manager and director of Double Line's global, their developed market practice for credit. Mm. And we were talking about tech as rock solid. You know, 20 years ago, telecom and tech was seen as really volatile in the same way that energy was in the credit space. But now it's seen as, you know, totally rock solid. So when we talk about tech these days, we're thinking about large cap techs like Microsoft, Facebook, Google, et cetera. And when we think about them from a credit perspective, we're thinking they're as good as it gets because they're so big.
Yeah.
But it wasn't always that way, obviously. And the interesting just from a purely economic perspective right now, what we see in terms of large cap tech, in terms of the stay at home versus not stay at home market, they're doing really well because not only are they rock solid, but they benefit from this environment. So everyone's like, tech is great. But then you look at what Kara Swisher had to say in the New York Times and you understand, you know, the seedy underbelly, I would say there. Because what she talks about is she talks about the fact that there's been these lawsuits that are coming. She says it's 22 years in the coming that Facebook finally is meeting some sort of antitrust from regulators. And she says that actually in the technology market, it's not about innovation. And it's not about new things bubbling up. It's really about those large cap tech companies like Facebook dominating by either buying up their rivals, you know, favoring their own products, or by in some way mimicking their rivals' products and then trying to drive them out of business.
Yeah.
So it's anti-competitive. And that's why they're so rock solid. And this needs to come to an end because innovation is going to be spurred as a result of that. So that's the big picture that I think is really interesting.
Yeah. You know, Kara Swisher, it's a hell of a piece in the New York Times. I literally finished reading it and started at the beginning again and read it again. Kara Swisher basically lays out the prosecutor's brief, so to speak, for the case for basically taking action against these huge tech companies. She focuses in this piece on Google and especially on Facebook. And the case is basically that these are companies, in her view, that are taking anti-competitive practices to effectively quash their rivals, suppress competition, consolidate profits. And it is a pretty damning case, indeed, that she makes this notion that these companies, and the most detail is on Facebook, have either gone after their rivals in ways that are anti-competitive, sought to buy those rivals, as you pointed out, and again, as you pointed out, or to emulate their functionality, as in the case of Snapchat, which is the last major social network that we've seen come online. And that was way back in 2001. So here we are 9 years later, and the landscape basically looks the same. It's a pretty damning case.
Yeah. So she does go into Facebook in particular with that 2011, Snapchat being the last thing that was actually innovative in that space. And I think actually, if you think about FANG, when people use the FANG with a double A, the only company that escapes any sort of scrutiny from this perspective is Netflix. But if you go down the list, you think Facebook, they're either buying up their competitors or they're imitating their products. You think about Amazon, they're supposedly favoring their own products, same as Google in search. And then Apple is because it's the only game in town for that whole ecosystem, is charging anti-competitive levels of pricing. Fortnite, as an example, Epic, I think it's Epic Games.
Yeah.
They are fighting Apple, as are a bunch of other people, with regard to what they consider anti-competitive practices. So the long and short is, by hook or by crook, these companies are trying to hold on to their fortresses. And it's to the point now where we have antitrust against them. Let me say this before we go any further. I mean, I was thinking about this Kara Swisher thing overnight, and I think we've been saying for some time that irrespective of whether Trump won the election or Biden won the election, we're going to get some movement on this issue. I think where the rubber hits the road in terms of that movement is if you think about what Trump is saying, he's actually talking about his own personal grievances, i.e. these companies are not giving him the say that he wants. They're basically censoring him is what he's saying. On the other hand, the Biden people are saying that these guys have too much power and we might need to look into them from an antitrust position. Those are essentially the exact same views, one viewed from a purely ideologically, it's all about me prism, and the other from a ideologically, it's all about the antitrust and that market prism. I look at Trump saying, these guys have too much power. And the answer is yes, they probably do have too much power, but he feels their power. And in a personal way, and that's why he thinks about it. Whereas the Biden approach is that, you know, these guys have too much power, and that's bad for the marketplace, and we're going to do something about that.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, and just to expand on that point, you know, the sort of the Trump personality issues are being what they are. But it's interesting that Republicans in general have, perhaps not in the same personal context that President Trump does, but they really do feel this sense of anxiety about the power that these tech platforms have in terms of their ability to, in their view, influence free speech on the web. So some of it is the personality issue with President Trump, and that just as a matter of pure fact is something that's going to end on January 20th. But the underlying issues that conservatives have with these tech platforms, Facebook and Twitter especially, is something that's not going away. And, you know, to your point, effectively what you have is two political parties who can agree upon basically nothing, agreeing on this, that large tech companies have too much power in the United States in 2020.
Yeah, so it's a fascinating thing. And let me just point out that when you go back 20 years ago, when Microsoft, more than 20 years ago, not 22 years ago, when Microsoft was being sued for antitrust, we had the Clinton administration that was basically getting rid of Glass-Steagall and deregulating like crazy in a way that people think led to the great financial crisis. So, yeah. You know, both parties in the United States contributed to this anti-regulatory fervor that led us to where we are today. Yeah. I would say that, you know, as we speak now, you know, the Trump administration is doing a massive amount of deregulation that they can put through in order to get the last hurrah from that deregulation push. It's only in this one segment, however, that is in the tech space where they see, you know, something where the pendulum has to swing the other way. So I think the tech space in particular is challenged on both sides, irrespective of what happens going forward. You're going to see a coalescing in Congress and in the White House together around the issue of these guys need more scrutiny.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's almost like the mirror image of what we saw during the Clinton administration in terms of deregulation and re-regulation of these technology platforms. You know, and just to talk and to add an exclamation point, perhaps, you know, obviously Democratic Attorney General Letitia James here in New York delivering that speech live. All the financial news nets covered it. And now you have, going back a couple of months to the antitrust action taken against Google, you have a Democratic Attorney General in the state of California joining that suit. If you think about that, an Attorney General in California from the Democratic Party, this is the power industry in the state of California, and you have the Democratic Attorney General joining that suit. So it does, you know, precisely to your broader point, suggest that there really is an immense amount of will to attempt to rein these companies in.
And, you know, I think most people are concerned about what's going on in Texas suing these other states because of the political process and the election and so forth. But what you're saying in terms of what attorneys general are doing, that's really where the rubber hits the road. This is what we should be caring about since we're a financial platform.
Yeah. I was just going to say, and exactly to that point, if you want to look at the financial case for this, if you want to get it out of the domain of kind of airy philosophy or analysis, just look at the chart. Pull up XLK. Look at the technology select sector spider, and look at it. First, look at it on a 5-year time horizon, and look how it outperforms the S&P, and then look how it outperforms NASDAQ as well, the other growth companies. And then flip that time horizon from 5 years to 1 year, and what you see actually is the continued outperformance of XLK versus the S&P 500. But you see XLK and NASDAQ composite tracking each other virtually to one-to-one correspondence. Why? Because the market capitalization of those companies have swelled so massively that if you want to know what XLK is doing, you can just look at the NASDAQ.
Yeah, so I would say that the big issue for investors going forward, you know, going back to the beginning of our conversation from a financial perspective is what does that mean, given the so-called rock solid nature of these companies? And the fact that many of them are the stay-at-home companies that have been outperforming. Here you have companies like Apple, as an example, which has almost no revenue growth, trading at multiples that are very rich relative to their growth. So if you do like a peg, you know, price earnings to growth, they don't look good. And so you throw in a regulatory mix into that. And Microsoft, by the way, is the odd man out in terms of that. Because, you know, they actually, no one's talking about them from a regulatory perspective. You get some serious haircuts to these companies. Yeah. So I think that 2021, as we go into the next year, the potential for these companies to underperform the market or even to drag the market down overall is high.
Yeah, extremely well said. I'll throw in one wild card. You rewound the clock back 20 years. I'll rewind it back 40 to the AT&T divestiture. The breakup of AT&T was the greatest financial bonanza for those shareholders, better than anything that would have taken place with organic growth, because what wound up happening was those companies split out into the RBOX, the regional Bell operating companies. The RBOX then spun out into a number of other companies. And if you owned stock in AT&T, you made out brilliantly. So from the perspective of potential shareholder value, obviously this is speculative. We're applying a paradigm, something that happened in the past, no guarantee that it would happen again in the future. But I would have to be pretty bullish if a company like Google or Facebook spun off into 5 or 6 different companies, and then those companies sort of followed suit and spun off again. I mean, you would have to think that the innovation that could be released by that, if you think about a company even the size of Real Vision, people have great ideas all of the time, and we have to say no. It's easy to say no to bad ideas, but it's terrible to have to say no to someone who has this amazing idea, and you say, actually, that's a great idea, but we have to focus on our core mission at Real Vision. That must happen all of the time, and when you think about a ship that's that massive, the size of a Google or a Microsoft or a Facebook, they must have so many opportunities for those companies. So in the interest of unfettered capitalism, it might be the best possible outcome for shareholder value to see some of those companies spin off.
Well, you know, I think that's a very good glass half full type of analysis. Let me give you the glass half empty analysis. The glass half empty analysis is one that says that the core issue that we're talking about, which is regulation, AT&T is an example of how it worked over the last 20 to 30 years. So they were split up into the baby Bells, but then, you know, you had companies like 9X and Bell Atlantic, which suddenly became, Verizon. And they reconfigured themselves into these smaller fiefdoms where really it was almost as anti-competitive as it was before, just in different guises. And then they moved into other arenas, gobbling up other companies along the way. And why? Because even though they had the breakup, we were in the midst from the 80s to the 90s to the noughties in this massive deregulatory phase. And only now, with AT&T now deciding, okay, we screwed up and we're over leveraged, and therefore we have to get rid of Dish, which we bought in order to continue to dominate, are we seeing any sort of moves? And those are moves that are actually precipitated by the market, by the fact that AT&T is over leveraged and they screwed up, and now they don't want to be a junk company, so they need to deleverage. So I look at it as there wasn't innovation. There was just a reconfiguration of the bigness that we saw before in different guises.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot of innovation for investment bankers. I should have said 1984, not 1980, in terms of the divestiture of AT&T. But no, you know, it is an interesting question. I just often wonder. I was thinking about Microsoft the other day. You think about their different operating units. You think about cloud services, for example, operating systems, office applications, hardware, gaming systems. You know, it's a really hard argument to see the synergies between those groups. To me, it feels mostly like distraction, right? The idea that you're running all of these very different verticals together. And, you know, obviously this is, I'm not a scholar of the operations of Microsoft. I'm just looking at it from a 50,000 foot level. You have to wonder if each one of those companies had its own CEO, its own board of directors, its own mandate to maximize shareholder value based on playing in those particular domains, would they potentially generate more revenue for shareholders? I think it's an interesting question to ask at the very least.
Yeah, I would agree with you 100%.
Yeah. And there is that sense, and Carr Swisher's article, to come back to it, there is that sense of an absence of innovation in a very real way on some of these platforms.
That's the big issue. Yeah. The bigness means that you stifle innovation and it becomes very stagnant. And,
right.
You know, just even overlooking the free speech issue, that's really from an investor's perspective and from a society-wide perspective of what technology brings. That's the biggest problem with what's happening now.
Yeah. You know, one point that Carr Swisher did not mention in the article that I was thinking about, just sort of in passing, was one of the challenges that that we have with thinking about this is historically, these antitrust arguments are generally done around price, specifically when you have anti-competitive practices, when you have like horizontal and vertical integration. If you think back, college history classes about the Sherman and Clayton Antitrust Act, what you hear was this is very bad for consumers because prices rise dramatically as competitors collude in some way or engage in anti-competitive practices. In this particular case, it's very challenging because there is no cost in double quotes to consumers in using these products. They're ultimately free. It's the old joke, right? If you're not paying for the product, that's not the product, you're the product, right? You're being sold to. And so this is a really interesting space in terms of law, in terms of economics, and in terms of the overarching philosophy of how people think of what anti-competitive practices mean today in 2020.
Yeah, I take a fairly, opinionated view here, rather than look at it just purely from a journalistic perspective. This is what's happening. The view I take is similar to what Carr Swisher was saying, and that is that it is overdue at a minimum for a look. These companies, they're not necessarily giving us massive amounts of innovation, and we do need to understand to what degree they're abusing their market power.
Yeah. And, you know, to follow up on that point about price, it's simply impossible to use price, right? I mean, I wasn't sort of saying it academically. I think it's pretty clear that price is not the right metric to use.
Yeah. I think that it'll be interesting to see where this goes, both at the state level, but also at the federal level.
Yeah, especially with the incoming Biden administration. And once again, I guess we can play the tape back. We're not going to know where we land in terms of the legislature until January 5th, when we find out, or thereafter, where we find out which party controls the Senate.
Hey, so Ash, you know, I showed you three stories that I was looking at. You saw that I was looking at Carr Swisher, so I'm glad that we talked about that. There's also this other story that I showed you from Bloomberg News. Actually, I gave you a link from the Financial Post. It's about water, that water is now trading on the CME. What did you think of that?
I thought it was actually fascinating. And the reason that water is trading on the CME now is because there's a perception that there's going to be a price impact, right? CME is doing this because there's an economic case to do so. And it shows that there's a perception, at least, of rising risk of the availability of water, especially in California. Now, I know that there are people who will say that this is some kind of virtue signaling that water is being traded. But look, I would say I love whales and dolphins, majestic creatures, lots of good organizations that do work to save them and to preserve the oceans. But there aren't a capital market solution to the problem of endangered cetaceans. The reason that CME is doing this is because there's the potential for significant profits. Otherwise, you don't roll out a line of business that looks like this. And to me, that's just a signal. You take it purely objectively, non-political. That's just a signal that there's a perception among some smart players, market participants, that there's a rising risk of a supply crunch.
And interesting, the headline says water joins gold and oil for the first time as traded commodity on Wall Street amid fears of scarcity. So it's the scarcity of clean water, the scarcity of water, and they're talking about California in particular.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Yeah, there's a documentary I watched, I forget the name of it, a couple of months ago about the situation in California water. There are towns in California that have like incredible crunches of getting access to the clean water. And, you know, it looks like something that you would expect to see in a developing nation. You see Americans walking with a, you know, like a 3-liter Tide bottle to go to a pump somewhere to fill up. You look at that and you think, boy, this is really something we need to think about.
You know, this is an issue that's been coming for a long time. I covered it before when I did a series called Boom Bust. It was a weekday thing that I used to do 4 or 5 years ago. And I think that it would be good actually on RV to have people to cover it, even if it's not a markets oriented view. I mean, because obviously this is all about the markets here with the CME, but there are two things that I was thinking about in particular. One is that whole market, just from an investment perspective of desalinization, that is there's this whole market where, and I think Australia at the time when I was looking at it, where they were taking salt water and turning it into water that was drinkable. So, I mean, there's tons of salt water in the world. So water scarcity isn't there. It's really the fresh water scarcity that we're talking about. The exactly. Second thing I was thinking about is with regard to natural disasters, water scarcity associated with that. Yeah. We see a natural disaster right now, which is actually a hurricane or a series of hurricanes that went through Central America, which is causing a caravan to move through potentially up to the U.S. border. And that's something that people are concerned about. It could easily be the case, and I know it has been in the recent past, that water scarcity in the developing world, not the developed world, causes migration patterns that really, you know, bring to bear a lot of difficulty in the immigration issue.
Yeah, and of course that has public policy and market impact, and also a human impact as well. I think also Israel, probably not surprising when you think about it. I guess a small desert country, very rich in technology. I believe they have a very active desalination program as well.
Yeah, so I think I'd love if people had some thoughts in the comments. Are they interested in water, you know, beyond the market stuff? And if so, then we can start looking and talking to different people who have very good informed views about it.
Yeah. And also to that point, Ed, jump in also on the tech issue, what your thoughts are there and what kind of coverage you'd like to see on this going forward, because I expect that this is probably going to be a story we're going to be hearing a lot more about in 2021.
Yes, very good. So I think there was a third story I sent you. It was actually Axios, the Axios version. I spoke to Max about this Wednesday. We talked about, I'm forgetting which one came first. We talked about the DoorDash IPO. Yeah. Then I spoke to Tommy Thornton yesterday after the IPO from Airbnb went vertical. And then there's this article. It's talking about the fears of a bubble actually growing louder. And, you know, here's how I would play this is that, yeah, those fears are justified. To me, the price action in both of these companies, which are on either side of the pandemic, you know, one DoorDash is a stay-at-home company. The other Airbnb is exactly the opposite, getting crushed by stay-at-home. And yet, both of them are going up ridiculous amounts. We're talking, you know, doubling in the first day. And with market caps that Tommy Thornton, he was comparing both companies to with traditional companies, are absolutely ridiculous. I mean, when I say ridiculous, I mean, there's no financial justification for these market caps relative to these other companies.
Yeah, let's look at the case of DoorDash, valued by private investors at $16 billion, current market cap around over $65 billion. I think it was a 66 and change.
Yeah, so I mean, there's no way that that company, just because great things happen in the stay-at-home market, that it should be trebling and quadrupling in market value. Even worse, obviously, is Airbnb, right? Because if you could use the same numbers, last private valuation versus the valuation on the market. And this is a company that's been devastated to a degree. You know, they've come back from the stay-at-home situation.
Yeah, another four-banger, right? And and you know, you look at that and you do wonder. It seems to me like the rise in prices, I buy the shares because I think you're going to value them higher and I can sell them back to you at a higher price.
Right. So, I mean, I think we finally entered the phase now. You know, Tesla was one company that was there, but we finally entered the phase where we can say almost objectively, this is a bubble. These are bad things that are happening. And if they're happening to the degree that they're happening now, is it not having a concomitant impact on the rest of the market? So I think we can finally say, I mean, me, for the first time, I can objectively see pockets that are similar to what we saw in the 1990s, the late 1990s. This whole IPO frenzy, you know, with these companies vaulting higher with no reason behind it. That's very scary for me because given we're in the middle of a pandemic, it suggests that there's a lot of downside risk.
Yeah, it's certainly reasonable to say that there are parts of this market that certainly appear to be very bubblicious. And it feels a lot like the 1990s, except I stayed out a lot later then.
Exactly. And you had a lot more hair back then.
Yes, I did. It might have been floppy.
And my hair was less white back then.
So, Ed, final thoughts as we come to the conclusion of this tech-heavy episode. What are you going to be looking at going forward, and how are you going to be evaluating this in the months to come?
Yeah, so interestingly, what I'm looking at going forward is actually not the things that we talked about today. I'm just typing to look at the numbers. I believe maybe it was with you I spoke to about this. The last time I made a prediction with regard to where we were going in terms of the shutdowns and the rollbacks. And the number that I was looking at was hospitalization rates. And I said 110,000 by, I believe, tomorrow. I think that I feel relatively happy to see that we're actually only at 107,258. And we have two more days of data to get to that level. To 110. So really, it suggests that the hospitalization numbers have not increased a ridiculous amount. We're about the levels that I was talking about. We went from 100 to 110 in about the same period of time, or I predict likely 109, maybe 110 by the data that come out on Sunday. And so that's good. But, you know, the death count and the case count is up 28% or 49% and 28% respectively over the last 2 weeks. That would suggest that we still have a long way to go, and hospital overload is probably likely. So for me, I'm looking to see near term what that does to the economy and whether it has any residual impact on these bubblicious sectors of the economy at the same time.
Yeah, while we're talking about these bubblicious valuations, terrible human impact from this disease still today.
Yeah, so I think the final piece of the puzzle in all of that is what happens in terms of the policy response.
Yeah.
So all of these three are interconnected. You have bubbles happening on the one side. You have in the real world a pandemic that's worsening despite the fact that a vaccine is about to be administered and cleared tomorrow, I believe. And then you have a dysfunctional Congress, which isn't able to address the problem of the pandemic. How do all of those three come together in a way that is positive or unfortunately potentially negative over the coming weeks? That's the real question in terms of markets and also in terms of the economy.
Yeah. You know, I've been off in crypto land here these last several weeks and months, focusing on that. But I've also recently begun to do a little bit of a deep dive on my own into the labor markets. And I would add that's really the place where the pandemic kind of meets the real economy. Those are the key numbers to look at. Haley Drasnan sent me a chart that hopefully we'll get to show sometime next week that to me is really the killer chart that basically shows where we are relative to other recessions in the labor market, and the recovery does not even begin to bring us up basically to the bottom of other negative adverse labor markets. And it's a very difficult thing for people who are not able to, you know, sit at their computers and, you know, jump on Zoom on a camera and do their jobs. It's a real thing.
Yeah, well, let's make a promise that you, next time when you and I get together on RBDB, we'll talk about that.
Labor market deep dive. That sounds fantastic.
Excellent.
Ed Harrison, thanks for joining us.
There you go, Billy Ray.
Awesome.